views and opinions expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium.
Lift your eyes up, let your wise rise up. See the signs of the times, if it's time, rise up. When death and hell dwell among all God's people, when those we chose and trusted have become completely corrupted and inherently evil, when the feast that feeds you starves our father's children, when snuff, porn, and pedo forms begin to get top billing, rise up. When famine claims millions, when
peace. And welcome to New Abolitionist Radio, a program that seeks to educate, inform, and agitate on the issue of 21st century slavery. Hosted by social activist and spoken word poet Max Parthas, with New Abolitionist and Actionist Yohanan Elia, and Black Talk Media Project founder Scotty Reed. On this program, we discuss recent news on legalized 21st century slavery and human trafficking, along with projects and people who help combat it. Today is August 10th, 2016. We'll go through this week's collection of stories, articles, and events with an abolitionist perspective. People want answers and solutions that can work right now. We believe we have a damn good question about our shared problems that, if asked honestly and truthfully, will provide both. Try this eye-opening experiment today. Read the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. It's only a few lines long. Then look at our for-profit prison and justice system and mark the sheer, unimaginable volume of human beings going through those perpetual processing centers every year, and ask yourself, is this legalized slavery? If the conclusion you come to is yes, then the answer is abolition and not reform. You don't reform crimes against humanity to make them more socially acceptable. You abolish them forever and place permanent guards to make sure they never come back, because given the chance, these ancient evils can, do, and will return. Our writer of the 21st Century Underground Railroad is John Thompson, who spent 18 years in prison for robbery and murder he did not commit, 14 of them on death row in solitary confinement in the infamous Angola prison in Louisiana. He was exonerated after evidence covered up by the New Orleans prosecutors surfaced after his seventh and final execution date was issued for May 20th, 1999. Our abolitionist in profile is Charles Bennett Ray, 1807 to 1886, conductor on the Underground Railroad, journalist, clergyman, and abolitionist. Expect all of that and more tonight on New Abolitionist Radio. If you'd like to share a comment or question, call in and join us at 1-641-715-3660. The access code is 549-032-POUND. Once again, I'm Max Parthas. What's happening, Brother Scotty? What's up, Yohanan?
Yeah, let me unmute you, Yohanan. How you doing tonight, Max? I'm tired, man. I'm about to fall asleep, man. I'm over here nodding with, you know, things that hit me unexpectedly, and I had taken on a new project, and then I had to do a new radio server. But I think the listeners, once we switch over to the new server, are going to appreciate the improved quality. We're going to have improved security as well. The audio will be more level. We're just upgrading to a different version of the software we run, and it'll just improve. So it's just been a long past 5 days, man, not getting much sleep, but just trying to get this stuff done. But I've made great progress, so that's how I'm feeling. So excuse me if I don't talk as much, because I'm actually still working, and I'm glad Yohanan, you know, will be in, because I love to sit back and listen to him. You know, I'm missing Abolitionist Daily, but okay, it's on hiatus right now, but okay.
In due time, brother, in due time, it will return. Peace. Good to be here, gentlemen. Good to be here, my fellow warriors, in the trenches constantly. It's very rare that I run across people that I feel like, you know, I can't even hold a candle to the work you do, you know? So it's always a pleasure to be here on Wednesday night, even though we're going through hell together. I mean, but I wouldn't want to go through it with nobody else. So I'm glad to be back, and we might as well get into it because they just served us another plate of the same old, you know what, warmed over.
Oh, man, is it ever. But, you know, before we get into that, I just want to make a quick apology to Scotty Reed for what I said last week. Just been burnt out and tired and all these things going on in my life. So, yeah, I didn't mean anything by it. Just want to make that apology.
Oh, man, no apologies needed, man, you know. And I did the same, but we good. That's behind us, man. Let's move forward.
Indeed. And I also like to offer my own personal apology to the caller we beat up, or you guys beat up on that call in. I'll try to avoid
did
doing
I, did,
that.
Did people. That come across like that, man? I'm just going to admit it, man. I was irritable, which you know why, Max. I was irritable. Again, very tired. You know, I will be that angry black guy. You know what I'm saying? I'm on a radio program. You know, I'm naturally by nature passionate when I talk. When I talk to people that's in the same room with me, sometimes they be like, man, lower your voice or tone it down a little bit. But I'm a pretty big guy with a big voice, you know what I'm saying? And so it come across like I'm angry. But a lot of times I am angry because of what I'm reporting on. And so I don't give a damn about white supremacist stereotypes about the angry black man. I got plenty to be angry about. I'm not going to be happy and skipping about and saying, you know, let's throw a party. So I'll be the angry black man. So I can understand why some people may take. I do have a brash personality sometimes, but hey, that's just me.
Like you, man, I'm burnt out. It's been a couple of days since I really slept any. My wife left last night to go to Maryland to help my oldest daughter burying her grandmother, who just died of cancer. And my middle daughter went for her third stage of chemotherapy today. So I'm just so stressed.
Well, condolences to the family.
Yeah,
condolences to the family and the tribal rain. Travel safe. Get home, back home safe.
Yeah, she's in good hands with my daughter and her new son-in-law. You know, they just got married over there, and she recently gave birth as well. So she's in good hands. But we got our hands full today, man. As usual, as Johanna mentioned, our list is more than we could ever share with you, so we have to try to prioritize. For me, a couple of things that I've seen over the past week that I want to talk about was the Baltimore Department of Justice report, of course. Olu Stevens, I want to talk about him a little bit. I also want to talk about President Obama and his commutations. And I want people to hear Corinne Gaines' son speak from the hospital as a witness to what happened at 5 years old. It's just a little short video, maybe 2 minutes long, where he tells his version of the story. What about you, Johanna? Anything on your mind that you want to share this week?
I mean, you mentioned, like, the obviously, to me anyway, the most important thing and the most timely thing that we get a chance to speak on. They didn't sneak it in after the program was over, so we got to be a week behind. We right on the breaking news as far as the Ferguson report. I mean, not Ferguson, the Baltimore report, which mimics the Ferguson report. So we've been saying Baltimore or Ferguson is America for the last year and a half. Here we go again.
I have a question for you, Johanna.
The same information. Yeah.
Well, it's really for both you and Max. And I, you know, again, I'm not going to be talking much tonight, but I do have this question. Earlier today, I was listening to Tanya Free and Friends talk show, which is a simulcast on Black Talk Radio Network on Wednesdays at 2. And that was brought up. And I didn't really know what they were talking about, you know, because I've been buried into this code and building these new platforms and then fixing the new radio station or setting it up. So anyway, they had somebody mention a report like Ferguson. So I guess I didn't catch the Baltimore report. So I'm behind on this story. But the way they was talking about it, I was saying, well, what does that report mean? The Ferguson report came out and they said, da, 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 da. Nobody went to jail, da, da, da. And ain't nothing really changed. So what's the point? You know, and what I learned from you guys on this program, 96% of DOJ cases involving cops violating somebody's rights end up in no charges. So, I mean, these reports mean, I mean, it's good in terms of documentation and admission in court or a legal document or what have you, but there's never any remedy. So, y'all, this is my question to you all. Has there been any relief in the areas impacted in St. Louis County, Ferguson, since the release? I know a couple people got fired, but has anything really changed?
Nope. I think we reported on the area, the court case where they were able to get what amounts to some reparations for people that have been wrongfully put through the debtor's prison process, like on collections-related debts or whatever, putting in jail. But as far as the racial profiling, race-based policing, the incentive to police these people and incarcerate these folks based on their race, the inequities between whites being arrested and detained who have the same or oftentimes more amounts of contraband and more incidents of having contraband on them when they are stopped and questioned by police, those numbers have not changed. It's still, I mean, it's business as usual. And this is not, this is like what, like the, this is somewhere around the 20th federal investigation of a Metro Police Department, if I'm not mistaken. So this has been going on for years that they've been doing this, long before Michael Brown. And it's the same report over and over again. First Amendment violations, Fourth Amendment violations, inhumane treatment, patterns and practice of racist police, baby, on and on, man.
Well, I think that for me, one of my fondest visions of what I would like to see is national trials being held for the people at the highest levels of office involved in this slavery and human trafficking on purpose. And we've already come to a conclusion amongst ourselves, I think, that the Department of Justice is involved in this heavily. That, and it's not pure ignorance, as the Attorney General tried to portray in front of Congress when faced with the news of that for-profit commuting industry that was killing prisoners, saying she didn't know anything about the private prisons. I think that they're consciously involved in keeping this going, but their backs are against the wall, so they have to make some kind of report. And there's honest people in the Justice Department. They're not all in cahoots. So these people are probably crying out, you know, we need to find out what's going on here. And we've seen them do this city after city after city, out in Cincinnati, in Ferguson, in St. Louis, in New Orleans, now you got it in Baltimore, over and over and over and over again. And this is proof, this is evidence that we could use in such a proceedings where we hold these types of trials, much like the Nuremberg trials, if not by the U.S.'s own volition, but maybe through a international type of thing. But that's a fond hope of mine for one day, because you can see right now, they let them get away with murder, literally. They come in and say, let's fix the problem. Let's correct the police mistraining. Let's provide them with body cams. And let's, you know, give them de-escalation techniques. But they never mention a word about the people who have already been victimized. They don't even care. It's like this Baltimore report doesn't mention anything about the lives that have been lost over these generational oppressions, about the people who have been incarcerated. We reported right here on this program how eight out of nine people in the Baltimore jail are black people. But see, those things are never mentioned in these Department of Justice reports. They're about the here and now, and point the finger at the police or the department rather than pointing their fingers at innocent victims and say, we need to save them. We need to get justice for them, because they have been hurt. They have been abused. Their rights have been violated, and somebody needs to give a damn. But we need to get people in office in those positions who are willing to go those routes. Right now, all we have is collaborators.
Scotty, I mean, does that help to at least approach answering your question? Or?
Yes, nothing has changed. The same pattern and practices continue. A couple of people lose their jobs. There's never any prosecutions like Max. And even if there is a prosecution, nine times out of ten, there are no convictions. So, yes, to answer my question, nothing has changed. So this report, Baltimore report coming out, you know, if I understood correctly the way they were saying it, like, you know, they are expecting something to change because the Loretta Lynch came out with this report. And no, that ain't no. If things going to change, it ain't going to be changed by the federal government. It ain't going to be changed by a CEO of USA Inc. while at the simultaneously they running their own corporate prison slave plantation, talking about unicorns. So, you know, I'm just trying to get people to realize the change is going to come from within. It starts in your household. It starts in your community. And it just spreads like that. When we convince enough people to practice justice instead of practicing slavery, then we'll see that tipping point. I'm like, Max, we need them Nuremberg trials.
Those attorney generals sequentially that we've had over the years often have been directly involved with the prison industry on a profitable level, whether working for them after they get out of being attorney generals or working as lobbyists. One of the first private prisons, Wackenhut, which is now known as the GEO Group and is one of the largest in the entire world, when they started, one of their founding members was an attorney, former attorney general. In the 90s, right before the Clinton crime bill came out, the former attorney general again was part of that initial launch, joining Wackenhut Corrections then. So these people go directly from criminal justice to prisons for profit. So it's hand in hand. It's like they're being rewarded for sending people to prisons. Let's read some of the stuff that came out from, I know people are saying, well, what happened? So let me read some of the quotes that we have from the various articles and then tell you some of the incidents that they're referring to. This comes from www.justice.gov, and it's the Justice Department announces findings of investigation in the Baltimore Police Department. And this part here that says, we found that the BPD has engaged in a pattern of practice of serious violations of the U.S. Constitution and federal law that has disproportionately harmed Baltimore's African-American community and eroded the public's trust in the police, said Principal Deputy Assistant Attorney General Vanita Gupta, head of the Civil Rights Division. The agency also fails to provide officers with guidance, oversight, and resources they need to police safely, constitutionally, and effectively. The department found reasonable cause to believe that BPD engages in a pattern or practice of conducting stops, searches, and arrests without meeting the requirements of the Fourth Amendment, focusing enforcement strategies on African Americans, leading to severe and unjustified racial disparities in violation of the Title VI of the Civil Rights Act and the Safe Streets Act, using unreasonable force in violation of the Fourth Amendment, interacting with individuals with mental health disabilities in a manner that violates the Americans with Disabilities Act, and interfering with the right to free expression in violation of the First Amendment. The department also identified serious concerns about other BPD practices, including an inadequate response to reports of sexual assault, which may result, at least in part, from underlying gender bias. Another significant concern identified by the department was transport practices that place detainees at significant risk or harm. Now, we know about that because six killers just walked away after killing someone using one of those rough rides that they do. Now, here's some of the examples of things that they found out, actual events. Officers publicly strip searched a woman following a routine traffic stop for a missing headlight. They even searched the woman's anal cavity. They found nothing. Imagine you being that woman. A black officer with a reputation for speaking out over misconduct was harassed by a supervisor who placed sign warnings him to stay in your lane and mind your own business on his desk. An officer decided not to report a colleague for planting drugs on suspects because he feared retaliation. An officer harassed a mother and her son outside their home, ultimately arresting the juvenile for loitering. The Justice Department found that the officers had been accused more than 60 times of using the word nigger, but the Baltimore Police Department didn't classify the language as a racial slur. An officer used a taser on a man who was yelling and swearing. In his report, the officer said the man's weapon was his mouth. The Baltimore Police Department's us versus them mentality led officers to treat the city like a war zone. You've got to be the baddest mother out there, one officer said, explaining his approach to policing. In emails between the prosecutor and a police officer, the prosecutor called a woman who said she'd been sexually assaulted a conniving little whore, and the officer replied, LMAO, I feel the same. During the Department of Justice ride-along, a sergeant told an officer to make something up to justify a bogus stop. A single officer received 125 complaints in just a few years. A commander instructed a sergeant to tell her officers to lock up all the black hoodies in her district. A form of trespass arrests already had black mail filled out. That's just some of the things that they found going on in Baltimore to the African-American community in particular right now. And there are people dying and going to jail where a 9-to-1 ratio because of this.
What I don't understand is how we are sitting here with a black, the second in a row black attorney general, the top cop in the country, in the superpower of the planet Earth currently, United States of America, the top cop being a Negro with a Negro president, and I'm going to venture to say 99% of all racist or racist suspects or racist proxies and just generally ignorant people would say to you that racism is overblown, racism isn't real, racism is in the past. We've got a black president we elected to 2 terms. We're past this. We've got black top officials of all sorts. Don't you understand? We're past these days. And here's the second black attorney general in a row to send out a report talking about these things in depth. And the 160 pages of this report is just what made it in the report. You just heard the man say the Department of Justice employee doing a ride along with a cop, the cop still talking crazy to the Department of Justice investigator. These people don't give no damn whatsoever. How does Loretta Lynch submit this report and allow this place to even stay operational? How do they just not just shut it down? You know, we're done. We're done. There's way too much going on. Too much opportunity for injustice, for racism, for people to lose their lives, for people to be losing their livelihoods and their freedoms. Behind all, I mean, you can't even end the names of all these peoples and these incidents that's going on, and you just write a report and be like, oh, well, we'll figure it out. We're gonna have another town hall and kind of talk about it and figure. Meanwhile, these people are going to work and doing the same stuff every day. If they're doing it with the DOJ right there, riding along investigating, what do you think they're doing when everybody pack up and put their books up and go home?
You know, we did the Baltimore's Ferguson report. It's the only city that we did a report on. We kept it to states, in contrast to the DOJ Ferguson report. We just went and covered the whole state to figure out we'd get all 50 of them rather than the hundreds of cities or thousands of cities that it may be. And some of the information that came out of that report was mind-blowing then. We knew what was going on at that point. It was the reason why we researched it. 9 out of 10 people in the jail are African-American in Baltimore. African-Americans make up the largest percentage of people in jail, despite making up only 64% of its residents. And they comprise 89% of the people held in the jail. Currently, more than 2,900 African-American men are incarcerated in that jail. Now, that's a form of genocide right there. There's more. I'm going to just read a little bit of it. The Baltimore jail is one of the largest municipal jails in the nation, more than 73,000 people. And I didn't stutter. 73,000 people go through the Baltimore Central Booking and Intake Center every year. And over 35,000 people are committed to the Baltimore City Detention Center annually. Now remember, 9 out of 10 of them are black. So that 73,000 is 70,000 black men and women. And that 35,000 is 32,000 black men and women. At the start of 2010, there were more than 3,600 men, women, and children in custody. But the annual average is about 400 people higher at about 4,000 people per day. And this is the last part of it I'm going to read. Baltimore is not only the home to one of the 20 largest jails in the country, but it also has the distinction of holding the highest percentage of its population in jail when compared to the other 19 largest jails across the entire country.
Hey, guys.
That is our Baltimore Ferguson report.
Hey, guys, real quick, I need someone to monitor the Facebook messages. Like I said, I got a lot going on, and I need to step away. So monitor that so I can communicate. We will forego.
All right, should we take our commercial now?
No, we're not going. I was just about to say we're going to forego that. We're not going to take a station ID to the top of the hour.
Okay, all right. Sounds good to me, brother. Sounds good to me. Johanna, anything to follow up on that with?
I mean, like you said, we've already been reporting on this with the Baltimore is Ferguson segment of the America is Ferguson series overall. And, you know, I just like to remind people of the term that we found out about on this program a while back, the million-dollar block. I mean, Baltimore is one of the cities that's home to the million-dollar blocks, where the cost of incarcerating people on a given city block in a given city zip code is higher than the value of the action of, like, the people, of their income, of their property, or anything. The cost of incarcerating them exceeding $1 million per city block. I mean, Baltimore is one of the main perpetrators, one of the main ones that's doing it. So
it's terrible. And, you know, they have this these information that have come out. Of course, the perpetrators of these crimes have come out with their press release, Kevin Davis, for instance, and he says that several officers have been fired as a result of the Department of Justice findings. But who gives a damn about a few people being fired? That's not solving the problem. Neither is this reformist perspective that the Justice Department is presenting to them, where they think that they can fix this problem. You can't fix racism. It's a racist situation. Please explain to me how you fix racism. How you stop racism. I'd like to know. I think the world would like to know that. Because that's the core issue here, is you have all of these racist and racist proxies, meaning those black and brown police and prosecutors and judges and all of those, who are perpetuating this oppression upon the people of Baltimore for generations. And you're just going to walk in, give them a few training, tell them don't say the N-word no more, and that's the end of it? That fixes it? Body cams? When they went to kill Corinne Gaines, they didn't have body cams. They were supposed to, from what I heard, but they didn't.
Again, this is not Groundhog Day. We're not doing this podcast from some, you know, time loop or something where we just say the same thing over and over again. And this is a new day. This is a so-called new situation. But it's the same old racism. It's the same old slavery, bottom line. So the thing that we find in common with this is the same thing we see, rather, in common with all of these reports, these DOJ reports, is that no one is talking about slavery. And you see no one talking about slavery when they're discussing racism. You see no one talking about slavery when they're discussing police violence. You see no one's talking about slavery when you're talking about the financial incentive to incarcerate people, when you're talking about prohibition. Because, see, prohibition didn't work with alcohol in the 1920s. It tore apart the nation, and it tore apart white folks' lives. This is before the suburbs and the hood. There were cities, and people just lived in or near the cities as best they could and fought for jobs and resources and access to the community as best they could. Black folks were largely still segregated from it being included in those areas, as we know, the Tulsa bombing 1921 and several other Black Wall Streets destroyed throughout the early 1920s and mid-1920s all around the country. So these were areas where blacks were self-sufficient and segregated. So the prohibition years of prohibition of alcohol are not marked as being as destructive to the black community as we're seeing the prohibition years of recreational drug use is targeting specifically black folks. Because police officer after police officer, whistleblower after whistleblower, prosecutor, defense, public defender, judges, court clerks, mayors, attorneys, whoever, coming out saying, we don't go into the white neighborhoods and do a damn thing. We focus on the black neighborhoods, because ain't nobody going to say nothing about us tearing up the black neighborhoods. I mean, right now, worst case scenario for black neighborhoods being terrorized by police, hyper-policing and race-based police techniques, the worst case scenario right now is cities will pay out an average of about from $10 to $15 million a year in abuse civil lawsuits, abuse related civil lawsuits. So major metro cities around the country all have this in common. Dallas, Baltimore. Baltimore had a $2.5 million cap on what it could pay out because it was paying out so many lawsuits for people that were complaining of getting beat, of people that were getting murdered, people that were being falsely arrested, falsely imprisoned. The lawsuits were going into the multi-millions every year, and they had to come up with a law in the city of Baltimore to protect the comptroller's pockets and stop all lawsuits at $2.5 million. Freddie Gray's murder became such a national and internationally publicized case. This is why a lot of people got mad at Marilyn Gray's office because, or Marilyn Mosby's office, I'm sorry, sister, because she was able to get $6.5 million for his family in his wrongful death before it even went to court. They just immediately gave him people $6.5 million in a city that had it as a law that it was $2.5 million capped. Dallas, Philly, L.A., San Francisco, all throughout Florida, all around the country. $10, $15, $20 million a year in payouts behind police brutality cases. Nobody talks about slavery, though.
Yeah, and instead of them trying to reduce the unlawful, what they call unlawful killings and what have you, but are murders, instead of trying to reduce that, they trying to reduce the amount to pay out. You know, that's not logical if you're trying to practice justice.
Not logical at all, Scotty. And you know, I had to change my way of thinking over the years because for a long time I was just fighting here slavery in America, thinking that, you know, that the worst of it was right here, what we was dealing with. And as I found out, this thing has encompassed the globe now. Really, this is just a small part of the whole prison for profit industry, which has become a global monster. And the world is dealing with this problem now. It's not just Baltimore. It's not just Ferguson. It's not just St. Louis and New Orleans or any state. The globe has to face the idea that legalized slavery has come back to life in a way that you feel like you're blinked and missed it. Like, what the hell? In 45 years, just 45 years, it's encompassed the globe to the point where one of the largest, and not even the largest, but one of the largest, is also the largest private employer on an entire continent, the continent of Africa, where the second largest privately owned prison company in the world is also the second largest privately owned corporation in the world. That's how large they've grown.
I don't know how that doesn't like blow people's minds. I mean, Apple has the highest rated stock, I guess, or Google, one of them. You know, I mean, we can see how many people use these items or use these services. You can see with some of the blue chip stocks. I mean, you know, the automotive industry, General Motors and Ford, and you know, these places where, you know, they're making millions of vehicles and millions of people drive this. I mean, you can see the logic behind a lot of these huge corporations. What is the logic behind a prison company being one of the largest companies on the planet Earth? How do you wrap your mind around that and then also say freedom?
You can't say freedom at all in this country because it would be a lie. There is no such thing as freedom when we're still selling human bodies on the open market. I said it before, Chinese kid, 12 years old in China, could buy black people right now just by getting on his computer and purchasing stock in private prison.
And all these people that we give our money to or help them make money by just our presence. I wonder, let's look at Zuckerberg's portfolio. I do want to see Donald Trump's, what he's invested in. We already have given a history on Hillary Clinton. What about President Obama? What is he invested in? But, you know, Johanna mentioned the world's largest, you know, the planet's largest private prison plantation is two largest based right here in USA Inc. You know what I'm saying? And then the United States owns one. That's what people don't seem to get. your corporation, USA Inc., COO Obama, all of your, you know, board members that you call representatives, they know that they own a place called Unicor, a company called Unicor, all right, that is straight up prison slavery. Prison slavery right there in your face. But that won't be in any of the debates. It hasn't been brought up in the campaign trail. While Bernie Sanders introduced some good legislation that would roll it back, he didn't bring it up either because he was sheepdogging, like Max said. So, you know, this is why I'm the angry black guy.
Well, we know how these things occur. We've been talking about it here for years. The money and the greed and the corruption that is brought to bear by a slaver institute, which is for-profit prisons and justice for sale, that is brought to bear, influences our entire justice system. It influences entire social structure in every way.
Max, in the new group on the new social media platform, community.blacktalkradionetwork.com, there's a group called Abolitionists. I just created it. We are in the beta version, but it's open. We got members and whatnot. But anyway, I posted a story about the GEO Group. An article was saying the GEO Group was buying. They were literally saying in this article, or figuratively saying in this article, that GEO Group was buying the two most powerful political couple or family in Florida, where we know they based in Boca Raton. But I mean, it's just straight up in our face. It's now even making the news headlines. You know what I'm saying? Where they just buying politicians. Darn, man. People wake up.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, that was a story I was going to lead into right after this, because it does fit into this conversation as to, you know, how these things occur. It occurs because they buy our politicians. With the story that Scotty is talking about is this private prison company has invested big in the Negron family fortunes out in Florida. And Florida is the home base of the GEO Group, the second largest private prison company in the world, and also the home base of G4S, the one that we just mentioned, who is the largest employer on the entire continent of Africa. I took some notes from that article, and I'll read you some of the information that I received. It says, what has been reported shows a clear pattern. Again, with the patterns, right? On June 25th, 2015, two months after Rebecca Negron announced she was running for Congress, the GEO Group Political Committee and GEO CEO George Zoli gave $15,000 to her campaign. On March 28, 2016, Rebecca Negron's campaign received 15 checks, ranging from $400 to $2,000, from most of the GEO Group's executive leadership team and some of their spouses, while the corporation gave another $10,000. The coordinated effort included two $2,700 checks from GEO Group's spinoff company, Correct Care Solutions. In total, GEO Group executives and their relatives gave $32,950 to her campaign. For example, John Bolton, the company's general counsel, gave Rebecca Negron $2,000. So did David J. Donahue and Brian R. Evans and M. Schlarb and David Ventura, all senior vice presidents. Ann Wiersma, wife of GEO Group senior vice president Thomas Wiersma, gave $2,000 on March 28, too. CEO Zoli and wife Donna also each wrote a $400 check, bringing the total each to $5,400. George Dominicus, head of the GEO Group's spinoff Correction Care Solution, also gave $2,700. See, the husband, Joe Negron, has also been a friend to the GEO Group's goals in Tallahassee. In 2008, GEO Group worked to secure legislative support for construction of a new privately run prison in North Florida and to win long contracts for the state for its existing private prisons. Now, when we say contracts, we're talking about those contracts that guarantee 80 to 100% occupancy for the next 25 years. These are the contracts that we're looking for. In 2011 and 2012, Negron and other legislative leaders tried twice to privatize 27 prisons and work camps. I can't even say that word without wanting to spit. Work camps in 18 South Florida counties. Their efforts were stymied first by the courts and then by a 21-19 vote in the Senate when a coalition of Republicans joined Democrats to kill the bill. In 2012, Senator Negron reported on his financial disclosure forms that GEO Group was a client of his law firm. The West Palm Beach-based Gunster, Yokley, and Stewart, one of the state's largest law firms. Joe Negron, who specializes in litigation and land use laws, did not directly represent the company. Indirectly, he did. Senator Negron no longer lists GEO Group as a client in the firm, according to the latest disclosure report. According to data compiled by the Herald Times by followthemoney.org, private prison industry companies, the GEO Group and Correction Corporation of America, spent $5.3 million on Republican races in Florida between 2002 and 2014. Finally, when he gave his acceptance speech to the Florida Senate this year, Joe Negron announced that one of his goals was to reform juvenile justice laws. Advocates suggest that may mean having the state contract with companies to steer offenders into treatment programs like the one GEO Group runs. So now he's aiming at the children. That's where your money is going. And you see how they bundle it? They get all the family and friends and employees all to make these small donations.
Yeah,
and
man.
These small donations eventually added up to $180,000.
But that's small potatoes. That's small potatoes compared to what they're able to give the super PACs. That's not the big money. That's just the maximum amount that you can legally give. But then,
right.
You know, the issue that has been brought up a lot is, you know, big money in politics, and that's where the super PACs come in. You know, that's unlimited.
Yeah, they had at one point put $50,000 into her campaign account through her super PAC. $50,000, and that was the third time they put a similar amount of money in there.
Well, I'm looking at a little bit different report from Mary Ellen Class, the lady who broke the Darren Rainey story a couple of years ago, and she's been deeply involved in Florida's prison culture, modern day slavery culture, and always coming up with the reports. And she gave, you know, similar numbers, but just saying overall it's over $288,000 that they've given to these people. I mean, I was in a conversation about this several times over the last few months, because when Sanders dropped out, you know, the rapper Killer Mike was out here pubbing for him or whatever, so he had his black pet, you know, out here telling black folks vote for Bernie. And when Bernie stood down, Killer Mike went, and he's, I guess, from Atlanta and got a couple businesses in Atlanta and, you know, known for the region, and was telling black people that, you know, what we need to do to get ourselves together and to, you know, to empower ourselves is we need to put our money in black banks and show these, you know, white supremacists that, we ain't playing. We're going to put our money in the black banks. And they had, I think they said it was like over 8,000 people went and immediately put at least $100 a piece in, you know, one of these banks in particular. So this is nearly $1 million that just showed up like in a week. And I mean, when you look at a story like this, it's telling you specifically how you're not really hurting white folks or hurting the system or ending the status quo by moving federally backed funds from one FDIC regulated bank into another one. They can't give you a loan that a Bank of America can't give you, or they won't be a bank loan. I mean, the reason they are able to be a bank is because they follow the rules and regulations, the federal guidelines. So if they start just giving Negroes loans just because they black, they're gonna be heavily regulated. They're going to be censured some kind of way. They're going to have somebody come in and take over control of the bank and shut all that foolishness down. That you are not going to be taking undue risk with these funds just because of somebody's race. You wouldn't let white folks do it if they did it some kind of way, obviously, and systematically or whatever. Whenever they're found to be, then they get fined and, you know, they get the bank gets in trouble. So just saying, that is not power. Clearly, this is the way that you control political power. If you're going to write legislation your own self and then take it to your paid-for congressperson, take it to your paid-for senator and say, okay, get this passed for me. I got three or four other senators that I paid this same kind of money to as well. They got you. They're going to vote for it too. So take this on in there and get this new law passed. A new law like 80%, 90%, or even 100% full to capacity requirement being legal. The fact that that is even legal to say these people that we don't even know exist are going to be put in prison to meet this 100% capacity rule that we're putting in this contract, the fact that that's even legal should tell you that money in the politicians in creating legislation and then getting it passed is the way to control the reality of how we live in.
It should tell you slavery is legal.
Yeah, that's a word there.
Yeah, that's a word right there, man. And, you know, they're invading other areas, too. It's not just the politicians making money hand over fist to fund their little projects that they're going on, they got going on. You know, right there in their home state of the GEO Group, collecting dollars and cents to do whatever it is they want to do, as long as they forward these agendas for private prisons. But it also has a lot to do with every other aspect of monetary transfer or commerce that's involved with prisons. There's one article that just came out from TheNation.com, Birth of a Prison Industry, and it talks about how they've set up this banking industry that only involves prisoners. They've got these cards that they provide them with where they can go make financial transactions from within the prison. They give them credit cards so when they leave the prison, they can continue doing it, where people can put their money into these accounts and they can take it out, or if they work for the pennies on the dollar that they do, they can take that money and put it into their account. But there's all these fees and fines attached to it that is huge. One of the points in the article makes, I'll read to you, it's just three paragraphs. It mentions this company called Noumi. Noumi is one of the many for-profit players in an increasingly privatized prison industry. State spending alone on corrections hit $52.4 billion in 2012. Hundreds of private sector contractors now provide food, clothing, riot gear, phone service, computers, and health care. In addition to directly operating many correctional facilities, in addition, prisoners and their families pay for the numerous services, including phone calls, a $1.2 billion a year business, according to the New York Times. At least 10 companies now offer release cards or inmate banking services to correctional systems. J.P. Morgan Chase does not give a card to each and every prisoner, but according to the Center for Public Integrity, it has a lock on the Federal Bureau of Prisons population, which currently stands at just under 200,000 at the state level. CPI found that JPay, the company founded in 2002, dominates, generating well over $50 million in revenue in 2013. It was acquired for $250 million in 2015 by Securus Technologies, a Dallas-based prison phone provider. But when it comes to county jails, Noumi has quietly become a big player. Noumi is now in more than 400 jails across the country, including large facilities that house up to 8,500 inmates. And the company issues more than 600,000 cards a year. That's enough to make Noumi one of the top 10 providers nationwide of prepaid cards of all kinds, according to Adam Russ, research director of the North Carolina-based Reinvestment Partners, which advocates against predatory lending practices. The Mercator Advisory Group estimates the entire U.S. prepaid card market was $594 billion in 2014. And you can rest assured that these jails and prisons are getting their share.
Well, remembering Securus introduced the video visitation, so, you know, they in on that, too. Removing that much more humanity from the experience for people that are incarcerated. And then also, I remember when Securus came out with that information about what they were going to do with the video visitation and how that was such a technological breakthrough. They had a black man that was doing the news, cable news, circuit reporting on it. So, you know, here we are again. This is
Remember, it affected me personally when I was in Jersey to visit my son. And they told me that, you know, coming from South Carolina to Jersey, I can no longer visit my son. I have to use this video technology, and I have to go on this website and register. What they didn't mention at that point is that I would have to register, put my account in, my banking account, so every time I log in, they would take away $15 from my account for the next 10 minutes. And every 10 minutes is another $15. So literally, they were holding my son hostage and selling him back to me in images at $15 for 10 minutes. Man, this is just terrible.
I'm speechless on that, Max. It's I was like,
saying they got you
damn.
In prison too.
What'd you say, Scotty?
I said I'm kind of speechless on that, just the rawness of how you said it and just how just right it was, right on the money, what they were doing to you, just in simple terms, or, you know, that everybody can understand that slavery was never abolished, man. They making all kind of money off of black bodies, man, putting them, you know, behind bars, using them as freaking chattel. Because, you know, people say, well, that was chattel slavery back then. This is a different kind of slavery now. Chattel just means property. They treating you, they herding you like cattle, right? Ain't that what, ain't that the common definition of chattel? Guys, I'm asking the question. Is
yes,
that,
yes.
That's the common definition. So tell me how.
Property that can be bought, sold, and traded.
So,
and worked.
So how do we not have chattel slavery today? There is only two types of slavery in America, or two different periods of slavery, pre-1865 and post-1865. It's that simple.
Yeah, it really Let me tell you about this odd coincidence, if you believe in coincidences. Okay, so chattel, definition being a personal possession, typically an item of property other than real estate. And this is how sick and pervasive the evil is among the players that's in this game. The private prison companies reorganized themselves, GEO Group and Corrections Corporation of America, to become real estate investment trusts so they could avoid various tax codes and laws and generate that just much more of profit off the revenue that they generate. So they become a real estate investment trust so they can control chattel slavery in the modern sense. And chattel is an item of property other than real estate. So if you think that it's not real, if you think this is not studied, if you think this is not a science, and you don't think they sit around someplace smoking cigars and having nice scotch and laughing at you because you can't figure it out, I mean, damn, just go bury your head in the sand, because you're just as effective.
It's so simple to understand, and it's so easy to get lost in the details. And when I say details, I mean the 60-some-odd stories and events that we cover each week that come up in our faces and we have to share. Those are just details all leading to one conclusion, and it's going to continue happening until we face this problem about legalized slavery and the idea that we went from personal property, people being personal property, to them becoming state property, and then back again to personal property through prison stocks and jail bonds. And if you're in Louisiana, you're personal property even without that, because these sheriffs out there run little kingdoms, and they own you lock, stock, and barrel in Louisiana, where you don't even get court-appointed attorneys anymore. You can't even afford them anymore. A violation of your constitutional rights is happening right there in Louisiana, where there are no lawyers.
Hey, interesting that you bring that up. I got contacted through one of the contact forms on Black Talk Radio News, an author who's coming out with a book in November, and I don't want to give away the title, and plus I can't remember. I know it begins with a T, but it's a county. There was a massacre of black workers. They had a labor strike. Thibodeau County, something like that. Anyway, he's written a book about this massacre. They estimate anywhere from 300 to, if I remember correctly, man, maybe over 10,000 white terrorists killing these black workers, man, and what have you. So Louisiana, again, they have seven times the prison population than China. China got an entire population estimated to be what? We say a billion. It might be more than a billion, like a billion and a half, approaching 2 billion. But how does Louisiana, one state that is part of USA Inc., paying taxes into that corporation that's in Washington, D.C., how does that one state have 7 times the population, prison slave population, than China, let alone North Korea or any of these other places? And then the president or the CEO of USA Inc., the Secretary of State, the UN ambassador, just get whatever, you know, can talk about this human rights violations in other countries. And this is going on right here. How is the federal government allowing this to happen? Well, because the federal government is engaged in it too. They own Unicorp.
It's the only answer that you can have to this, that they're all in collusion with this up at the uppermost positions of power, from the president on down. Not the little guys. The little guys out there doing what they're trying to earn their weekly paycheck and doing what they think is right. But above their heads, there's supervisors and people in positions of power who are saying this is all okay and doing little dances and shuffles to distract you from what actually is occurring. An example of that would be our president, Barack Obama. And, you know, recently he's been bragging about his commutations. But I'm not so sure people even know what a commutation is. And also how his record reflects in previous records. So there's an article that came out, and I'll read a little bit of it, and I'll share it with everybody. It's from Quard. It's titled "Obama's Prison Commutations Not as Cool as They Seem." And apparently this is from another brother with enough sense to read and see what's going on for himself. And he says, "First of all, as a criminal defense lawyer for more than 2 decades, I know what a commutation is and know that it's somewhat different from clemency and much different from a pardon. A commutation is merely the reduction of a sentence currently being served. It does not vacate that sentence. Clemency is simply an act of mercy that has 3 forms, including a commutation, which was just defined, a reprieve, which temporarily suspends a sentence so the person can petition for some kind of relief, such as having a death penalty execution put on hold while an inmate's lawyer seeks a life sentence, and a pardon, which is the best of all 3. A pardon is full and complete forgiveness, as if the conviction had never happened. That's my beef with President Obama, who, despite being better than any other president in U.S. history, far too often acts just like those old white men and sometimes even goes beyond their war hawkishness, their privacy invasion, their militarization of the police, and worst of all, their promotion of white supremacy in the criminal so-called justice system, education, housing, and employment. As the president of the United States, he can't be expected to be a black revolutionary or even a black activist. But he could do at least as much for us as he's done for the gays, transgender people, women, and the disabled, all of whom have been oppressed and all of whom are obviously quite deserving of equality and justice. I ain't here to hate on the president because I understand the political limitations on any president, especially a black one, and anybody who would disagree is delusional or lying. But let's get back to the commutation stuff. Although that 562 number seems great, it's really not. And here's why. In 2011, then-Attorney General Eric Holder officially announced the president's new clemency initiative and said 10,000 federal inmates were potentially going to be released. Based on that initiative, however, 562 is not 10,000, not even close. In 2014, President Obama said his initiative would reduce the draconian sentences that stem from the purported war on drugs created by Richard Nixon and accelerated by Bill Clinton. By the way, of that 562 number, as well as the potential 10,000 number, at least 1,500 are actually unarguably and immediately eligible for release based on the specific language of the president's own initiative. And Obama's White House counsel, Neil Eggleston, as recently as August 3rd, described the laws that led to such sentences as outdated and unduly harsh, while the president and his counsel talked the progressive talk, they hypocritically walked the regressive walk. Well, we're going to take our break, and we'll talk about this more when we come back on the other side. You're listening to New Abolitionist Radio. We'll be right back after this.
Radio since 2008, providing new black media for the masses.
Peace and welcome back to New Abolitionist Radio. We were just talking about the president's commutations, and one of the things that popped up also in that article I did think I should read so you understand it even more. It says, and as Quartz, a global business news publication pointed out on May 5th, although President Obama has made history with his number of commutations, he nonetheless has been one of the least merciful presidents ever in regards to pardons, which instead of merely cutting a sentence, erase a person's convictions, charge, and arrest. As a matter of fact, he's denied 1,629 pardon petitions and granted only 70 during his entire two terms, which is the fewest in history since John Adams, who became president 219 years ago in 1797. The worst since John Adams in 1797.
That's freaking just... I'm speechless. Damn. John Adams didn't even have a prison population.
He's just doing a juggling act to make himself look good. That's like, I'm doing something, y'all. Check me out. See, I signed this paper. Isn't it wonderful? And then they say words like 10,000, 60,000, which never actually occurred. And then they bring out this commutation 592. And a commutation is just a reduced sentence. And usually the commutations are for people who are about to get out anyway. And you just gave them a couple months off from their sentence and let them out early. It's really cruel and evil at the face when you start understanding what's happening here.
It is. That's what makes it so easy to come across to people who are on the wrong track, who maybe have not yet accepted the reality of the truth, who are still hopeful that there's a brighter day, you know, and all they got to do is be good and go to work and pay their taxes and it's going to work out. If we vote the next, you know, I mean, these people, there's so many different categories of delusion. And this is why when you encounter what we're talking about, you tend to feel like we're angry. You tend to notice we're agitated. You tend to notice a tone, a seriousness. You tend to notice what we're talking about in response to it is aggressive and exact, and talking about striking blows that will leave marks, not playing pity pat. Because when you know how evil it is, when you know how specific. This is like Obama, the neurosurgeon. The level of exactness, the level of precision that he's using with his pen, like a scalpel, a master surgeon just going in there and working around and cutting lightly here and dig right there and just boom, pow, exactly, just doing exactly what he needs to do to look like something but not really be a damn thing. And people are so ignorant and so delusional and so apathetic and so irresponsible and so lazy and so damn complicit in the slavery that, I mean, this is why we sound how we sound.
And we're not finding any kind of help from within the system itself. You got a lot of people talking about joining the system. Just had a recent stem of people who have graduated as lawyers and attorneys and stuff like that. But we're not seeing this happen changing anything. Those people are just becoming part of the problem. They're literally making a career on oppression and making their paychecks on it. Because if we were seeing some changes, there would be manifest, right? And all we're seeing is these okey-dokes, these, shuffling the cards and giving you the, marked cards and whatnot. It's crazy, dude. For instance, Judge Olu Stevens is an example. This brother's a black judge in Kentucky in good standing, who finally got tired of what was occurring in his courtroom. He was tired of these black defendants facing all white juries because these attorneys and prosecutors were setting the juries up that way, and finally disbanded the jury and demanded that another jury be put in place that had some people to that would reflect the diversity of the community that he's in. But in doing so, he went against white supremacist rule. And now he's been suspended for 90 days for simply implying that racism might be evident in all white juries. That is like right there, it tells you what's going on. You got a black man on the stand. You got 12 white people in the jury booth. What do you think is happening? There's no implying that is racist, period. You don't even have to explain it. But this brother...
Yeah, I was just going to say, apparently, though, being taken aback by these things indicates that there's a problem with you.
Right. You're bucking the system. And look what happens when you buck the system. Now, his career is in jeopardy, but you know what? If he gets terminated, I can't say I would be disappointed. I just can't say I would be disappointed because, as I said earlier, becoming a part of the system is not helping us. Especially if when you speak out, this is the effects. So you either toe the line or you don't.
Right. If he got canned, man, I would believe him. I would believe him more if the system spit him out. If the beast can tolerate him in its system, then he's a part of the system. So if the beast gotta spit him out, come on back, brother. I mean, you did some recon for us. How come we can't see the big picture like how our enemy sees the picture? We just talked about politicians that spend a career in politics and in public service, as they say, and once they leave their career in public service, they go immediately to the private sector and go work for the enemy. They got all the inside information. They hired the majority of the people who are going to be facilitating any of these affairs in their absence. They hired them. Gave them their first job, gave them their first opportunity, raised them up through the ranks and looked out for them and nurtured them, taught them, showed them how to go about doing the job the right way, rewarded them, met their families and helped them, when they bought their first house and consulted with them and all of these things that have gone on for decades with these people. And then they pick up, they pull up stakes, they take their buyout, they roll over their 401k, they do whatever else they do, and then they show up at the GEO Group's front door, and they go from $150,000 a year as the head of the Bureau of Prisons, and go over to the GEO Group and take a board seat, and immediately begin generating $1.5 million a year plus hundreds of thousands of stock options. So how come we can't take Judge Stevens as being on the other side and learning all the players and learning all the laws and knowing exactly and precisely how to dismantle? Instead of arguing against the system in a way that appears argumentative and appears to be confrontational, knowing where the system is weak at, come on out of there, brother. You did your recon. Come on back and now give us the keys so we know how to dismantle it from the inside out.
Hello? Oh, okay. We're still on air, right?
Yes, sir. We're still...
Oh, okay. Yeah, indeed. And you know what he did, man? They beat him into submission. Like, literally, they held his career over his head. and threatened him and beat him into submission. And his statement was, I have no personal animosity towards, I recognize how serious it is to accuse someone either expressly or implicitly of racism, Stevens read from a prepared statement. I do not believe Tom Wine is a racist. I apologize for any statements that implied as much. And that's it right there. Toby.
I wouldn't have said a damn thing. I wouldn't have said shit to them. Dude, at all. Not in, but again, they wouldn't have let me be in this situation in the first place. So I don't even know why I'm talking like they would have let me make it. I would have been the longest serving court clerk, overqualified, trying to get into being a judge. They would have never let me in the seat in the first place. So
I've actually seen them do this to eliminate black jurors on purpose. I was part of a case a few years back with a friend of mine, James Tucker, and we was riding down these South Carolina roads in the middle of the night because another friend had just come from California, and we were having this gathering, you know, artists from all over the country. So he ended up getting stopped driving while black in a nice car in South Carolina, and they gave him up to $600 in tickets and fines. So he wanted to fight it because he was innocent, and he was. So we went to court, and I'm watching them pull this jury together. I'm sitting there, and black person after black person is being eliminated. Until finally they had 11 white guys and one very light skin, maybe Hispanic, maybe black, I'm not sure, guy that was left against this one brother. So they purposely did that. 11 white people and one multiracial. It's a shame to see it happen and to know that you have people who are supposed to be there for legal purposes, for, to enforce the law or to keep the law and the integrity of the law intact, are doing these racist acts. So the bottom line is this. If you're making an all-white jury, that's a racist act. Guess what that makes you?
Yeah, the law was written for that purpose. I mean, I refer to in the matter of color in conversations on race and law and legality almost every day, it seems, lately. Because when you really want to get into what created even racism itself in this country, it's the law. You come from a country, just like we could talk about police come from slave catching originally, putting down slave rebellions originally, and therefore also enforcing the racist laws that were written originally. This is as old as the colonies themselves. Not even America, which wasn't until 1776. Hell, we talking about, okay, if you could say slavery been over for 150 years, get over it. Because 1865 till now. I mean, that same amount of time was from 1620, the reported first landing of slaves at Jamestown, until 1776. They didn't get over it. They kept pushing it another 200-300 years. So what would make you think that what happened in 1865 is going to be different now? These people come from a history of hundreds and hundreds of years of perfecting what they do. And the laws that were written in the 1600s forbade white people from buying from black merchants. And if you were caught having bought goods, they traced the goods and traced what you had or whatever in your personal home back to a black or an Indian indigenous person's shop or you know, wherever their merchant stand or however you got it from somebody that wasn't white. You paid a fine, you forfeited those goods, and you paid a heavy fine. Not no joke, a heavy fine. And this was enforced against, mostly in the beginning stages, enforced against the wealthy. So they created an attitude amongst people that actually had money. Like, nah, I ain't messing with them people. I don't want to deal with the legality of it. And then the common man himself competing for jobs and competing to sell goods in the market. He want to be a merchant too. This is a person that on political level is endorsing these racist laws because it benefits him. The law being used to create racial division and hatred. That's the history of it. So it's not going to be different in 2016. Than it was in 1616, when you could have just left people alone to find their own natural path and see who comes and who can make it. Natural selection, who got the best goods, who can make money, who's smart, who's needed, who's a valuable person to the community. No, we can't have that. We don't know. That's too net. No, We got to kill some. We got to imprison others. We got to enslave some. We got to write laws to exclude others. We got to do this and do it, let it go on for 400 years. And then say one day, okay, we're not doing that now. Everything has changed. Here's a black president. Here's a black attorney general. You should be able to, you're free. You can do whatever you want to do. Don't look back at the past. Don't look at the evils of the, come on, let those things go. And make this black judge sit up here and apologize and make this statement. I ain't heard not a damn one of them cops in Baltimore say anything other than they about to sue Marilyn Mosby. You one killed a man.
That's like $150,000 in back pay.
Never said a word to acknowledge the fact that you killed a man because he made eye contact with you and took off running because you had arrested him dozens of times. People act like because that man, Freddie Gray, had all those arrest charges on his arrest or whatever record, like he was guilty of all those things. He was arrested for all kind of BS little mess they could justify arresting him for and kept his life tied up in the system where he perpetually would be in it and owing the city and owing the courts. He would never, he would never be free. He would never get free of it. So yes, when he saw the police hit the block, damn, I'm out. Nah, you ain't out. Come here, you taking a ride. Oops, we killed you. Well, you know the deal, man.
Walked away. But you know, this brings us back again full circle. We got to get on the same page, and I don't mean us here. I mean, just as a nation and as a people, we got to get on the same page. You want answers. You want solutions. You want things that will work. We're telling you what it is right here, right now. We've got more research and proof and evidence to show you how this will work. And the only reason it didn't work the last time is because abolition is like a magic word. You know what I mean? Abolish. It gets rid of something forever. And you know what the counter to that magic word is? Accept. You can't have abolish and accept in the same sentence because the latter makes the former a lie. And that's what we ended up getting thanks to the betrayer, the great betrayer, Abraham Lincoln, who allowed this 13th Amendment exception clause to be inserted in order to simply convert private chattel property owned by the individual into state chattel property that the state could use to make its money off of. And full circle, what I mean is, if we don't get on the same page, we're just fighting these individual battles like Corinne Gaines just fought and lost her life. You know, people have different opinions about that circumstance. For me, I don't see where she did anything wrong. And I can imagine my daughter's doing something very similar. And she lost her life due to it. Her son was a first-hand witness. He was right there. Not only was he a witness, but her son was shot by the cops because he ran. Because a 5-year-old boy ran after these police in raid gear broke into her private house with petty warrants from stemming from a littering fund. But it was really just vengeful acts by the Baltimore City Police Department. But I'd like for you guys to hear this 5-year-old boy's version of what occurred that day. Scotty, are you there? Can you play that? I just put it on New Abolitionist Radio, so all you gotta do is click play when you're ready.
Yes, sir, I'm here. I'm just waiting on it to load.
All right. Yeah, this young brother right here is gonna be a force to be reckoned with when he gains age and knowledge and wisdom. He's already got more than most of the people I already know.
Okay.
You're listening to New Abolitionist Radio.
Take your time. Start from the beginning.
Corinne Gaines' son.
So, the police kicked the door down, and then I was hiding in the closet. And then my mother had a gun out, and then me, I was in the closet, and then Corinne was hiding the door. So Carson was hiding the door, was 12. So my mother didn't want me to come out, so I come out, and then I had my camera. Because it's just home because I left it, Mom. talking about it. So my mother said back off, and then she didn't say back up. So the police said, please back up. And then they started shooting. And I slid in the couch. And then the police just took me with her. And she died. P.N.
So they shot my sister?
Yes.
And they shot you too?
Yes. Because they saw me run. And then they hurt my arm.
So they shot you on purpose?
Yes. It's a toy gun.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sitting next to my mother. And then we were sitting right there. And then the police didn't let us go to the rooms. So Kareem was gone. And so he took caution. So the
he tried to take you with him?
Huh?
He truly wanted you to go with him?
No, I wanted to stay with my mother.
No, but Kareem wanted you to go with him?
Yes.
What'd you say, no?
No, I was just standing there. And then I wanted him a new phone because he coming to give me a new phone.
So what happened? You ain't finished telling me the story.
So we sneak in the bathroom, and then the
loading problems.
That's the end of the clip. It's only like 2 minutes.
Five-year-old boy shot by police on purpose for running. So we need to get on the same page, because these are the people, these children are those who are always affected the most. This boy is an orphan now. And nobody's being held accountable. Nobody at all. As a matter of fact, they're demonizing her. And by default, demonizing this young boy's dead mother, who was very brave in my eyes, and the boy just as brave.
I'd like to just put it on record. For anybody that listens to this, you know, live or you know, in the future, the podcast or what have you, I told you so when it goes down, because it's going to go down. Because we do what we do because we do what we got to do. None of us is here because we want to be here doing this. None of us wants to find this information. Nobody wants to know that this is what the real score is. Nobody wants to study this and put pain in your chest and in your stomach sick and your heart hurt, your eyes tired, you crying, you sad, you frustrated, you don't really relate to other people very well in social environments because your mind is on what's real and what's serious in life. And you know, people like to jack around and play and screw and laugh and lie and pursue life's happiness and act like ain't none of this happening. So yeah, it's a horrible situation to be in, but we can't do anything but this. But let me just tell you, when this little boy and all these little children that's growing up smarter and with more courage than a lot of y'all got grow up and revisit these situations on these oppressors, it's probably going to be the end of this country. Because if you got people that are supposedly terrorists attacking us, which I don't even believe is really real in most of these cases anyway, but when you can allow for these so-called terrorist attacks to be occurring because we're bombing the hell out of all these countries, so we get people to come here and want to kill American citizens because they mad about, you know, they people got killed by American bombs. Okay, if that logic stands, and again, I don't even necessarily believe that all these cases are organic, you know, people, some kid grew up and traveled over here and shot up, you know, 10 white folks at a movie theater. I don't necessarily believe that's true. But if they're putting that in the narrative, that means they feel like that's a plausible scenario. But here in this country, you are actively terrorizing millions of your own people here. every day of their lives. You're to a point now where you got this little child who is articulate enough and giving a detailed account of you murdering his mother and shooting him. It ain't even like you just killed his mama and he just wonder what happened. He said his mama is dead and they shot him. He's there. He knows he was shot by the police. What do you think the odds are that he's not going to grow up some kind of way? I mean, damn, if he don't do nothing but just, I don't know, walk up and kick one in the balls or something. I mean, how do you think this kid is going to not want to mess
somebody up? He's going to be on that list, Yohani. Yohani, he going to be on CEO's kill list from you know, by the time he hit 10 or 11 years old. I forget, you know, because they got a certain criteria. They say if you're at least 16 in one of these countries, well, it's acceptable to kill you with a drone, whether you civilian or not. You might be joining, you know, whatever organization or this or that that's opposed to U.S. interest. So he going to be watched, you know. And I'm thinking about Brother Mumia. I'm thinking about Brother Mumia Jamal, who's on death row. They start watching him when he was 14, when he was just working on the newspaper of the Black Panther Party.
Yep. So this is the reality of the truth. I don't know who is going to come from where and dispute what we're talking about here. That's the thing about this program, is you almost feel like you're operating in a vacuum sometimes, because there is no naysayer. We're not lying. We're not delusional. We're not puffed up. We're not excited and coming up with hyperbole and crazy scenarios and talking about unicorns and magic rainbows. We're talking about the absolute God's honest truth. I don't believe that there's a person on planet Earth that is telling more truth with every word they say than what we say on this program, breaking down what's going on to people. This is the this is where the rubber meets the road. There ain't no room for interpretation. We're giving it to you raw. And it don't ever be nobody that just shows up and is like, well, if you look at it this way, because they can't do it.
No, they can't. And in the meantime, the message is growing and it's spreading, and more abolitionists are coming to their conclusions every day. And that's all it takes for you to change your mind. It's real, real simple. If you look at this problem as an error in judgment over time, if you look at it as mistakes in policy, if you look at it as oversight, oversight or lack of oversight or problems that can be fixed, then that's how you're going to treat it, like it's something that can be fixed. But if you look at this as slavery, it becomes a different creature. Now it's a crime against humanity, and you don't want to fix crimes against humanity. You don't reform those. You abolish them without exception. You abolish crimes against humanity that have been codified and are made legal through your Constitution with an act of abolition. And that ends it. And you don't allow no, bait and switch to come in, no Abraham Lincolns with except for prisoners, none of that. Slavery is abolished in the United States and all of its territories, period. How hard is that? How difficult is that? But leaving that little loophole open allowed slavery to come back to life today on a scale that I personally believe is larger than it was in 1850.
I want to say this about the shooting. There's nothing you could say about her behavior. Certainly nothing about his behavior. Nothing about the behavior of the man who wasn't there, who left with the other child. There's nothing you could say about anybody's behavior but the police. Unless you think it's acceptable to send an armed, militant, highly trained, killer unit to get a woman on some misdemeanor charges, because she wouldn't let you in the door the first time and she wouldn't told you no. So you going to bring out a highly trained, probably some veterans on there. They probably kicked in a few doors and shot a few people in Iraq and Afghanistan, wherever they come back from. And so, what? When you knew it was a five-year-old child in there. But if they don't give a damn about the Palestinian child, the Iraqi child, the Afghani child, any of these childs, the Yemeni child, the Libyan children, the Somalian children, come on, they telling you right in your face that it's open season. And age don't matter. They've been lowering the age for I don't know how long since they've been charging children as adults. Now we're seeing, oh, it's justified to shoot them too.
We keep it real simple here, Scotty. How do you end this injustice in the justice system? End slavery. How do you free all of those innocent people in prisons right now, in jails? End slavery. How do you cut down on all of these militarized police forces that are out here collecting payments for justice for sale, prison for profit, and slavery? Just about anything that we're dealing with on this type of level can be solved by simply ending slavery. But you don't want an easy answer, do you? You want the long, drawn-out answers. Like how we do this, how we do that. Level by level, step by step. How about if we just go with end slavery and work outwards from there? You're listening to New Abolitionist Radio, where we're here to end slavery. We'll be right back after these messages.
Black Talk Radio Network is made possible in part with help from the Black Talk Media Project, a North Carolina-based nonprofit engaged in the production and distribution of independent digital black media. Find out more by going to blacktalkradionetwork.com or blacktalkmediaproject.org and look for the menu tab, Crowdfunding Black Media. Black Talk Media Project, helping to provide you with new black media for the new millennium.
You are tuned in to Black Talk Radio, new black media for the new millennium.
Peace, so welcome back to New Abolitionist Radio. Before we go into our next segment, which will be our rider of the 21st Century Underground Railroad, if we have any callers, Scotty, we'll open up the line for a quick call or two. Or are we clear at the moment?
We clear.
All right. Well, unless you guys have something else you want to put out into the atmosphere.
Yeah, again, I just want to say just how absurd and keep stressing how absurd it was for them to go in there with lethal force knowing a five-year-old was in there. But then even if she was in there by herself, there are less lethal means that you could. I mean, we watch TV, and a lot of times the TVs copy and know, the technology that the police have. I mean, there was no attempt that I know of to throw in a flashbang grenade and disorient the person, no shotgun beanbags, no rubber bullets, all these other people. I mean, I don't want to go into it and keep stressing it, but, just with the five-year-old presence in there, you would think that they would try less lethal means. I mean, even if I got a bulletproof shield, I'm telling you, if I had signed up for that job, not knowing this woman's state of mind or her history, but knowing she a human being who's frustrated and I shouldn't even be here because these are misdemeanors. When do you call the squat team out on some misdemeanor failure to appear, and all of that? And then knowing that going in ahead of time that there is a five-year-old. But I would have rushed her with my bulletproof shield. I got on a bulletproof vest. I'm sure they can make bulletproof thigh pads and all that. I mean, come on, they have gear for where, the guy goes in to disable the munitions and what have you, And so it was many ways that they could have took that woman alive and as well as not put that boy life at risk and actually getting him shot. And nearly killed. So, what I'm saying? I can't Scotty. Stress enough how unacceptable this is.
Scotty, the mafia are more merciful with their extortion programs than the U.S. government.
Now, you're talking from a standpoint of seeing these people as human beings. Everything you just said, all those considerations, all that careful consideration of consequence, any concern whatsoever, any kind of thought whatsoever, this flies in the face of what we know to be the truth about about police recruiting measures in the first place. I mean, we've reported on how the police don't even hire people that score over a certain point on the testing. The psychological profiling has to prove that this is an individual who does not feel empathy. This is an individual who does not think for himself. This is an individual who does not have any kind of independent thought or any kind of motivations. This is an individual that follows directions. This is an individual that does what he's told. This is somebody that's completely sold out from the soul level on up. Yeah, they could talk about how they deserve to go home to their families. They could talk about all these other things to try to make these people human. But the simple fact of the matter is that their recruiting techniques weed out humans. Their recruiting techniques, their hiring practices weed out people, real people. And they only hire androids, drone bots, automatons. That's what their own practices say. So it's not us talking bad about them. Check the record if you're listening to this. Across the country, the hiring practices of the police departments is on record in plenty of places that they will not hire people that think for themselves. So when you say that they think about this woman as being a human and they should take consideration of her life, there's nobody in the room that could do such a thing by design. And then you add in that it's likely veterans, like you said. If the United States population reflects, like David Clark was asked on the Senate committee hearing on 21st century policing and police techniques, he was asked by the political officials that sat there and ran them all through the grill or whatever and asked them, okay, if we know that there's a certain percentage of people in the country, America itself, it's something like 40 million people estimated to have mental illness issues to some degree or another. And then you're talking about recruiting largely from the military, veterans, and giving them preferential treatment and giving them fast track into getting hired into these jobs. And we know that a great majority of military has been on active duty in conflict situations for the last decade. And so you bring in these people with PTSD and you're going to tell me the police departments know all this information about black-on-black crime? The police departments know all this information about black criminality and the likelihood and the probability and the numbers and the statistics and all of these things they could say about all these citizens and what they do, but the police don't know how many of their own officers are suffering from mental illness? You don't have any clue about those numbers? David Clark sat there and said he didn't know. Next question. So they don't even know how many of these people are nut jobs that's in this woman's house terrorizing her. This whole shit is a damn sham.
A sham. I guess it falls down to that moment of decision for all of us. What do you do? Because there's no help. There's nowhere to turn to. You can't call the cops on the cops because the cops have beat your ass for calling the cops on the cops. Like they just did with the young woman who called 911, 911, because the cops were there harassing her and trying to falsely arrest her. And because the cop was so upset, he ended up arresting her and brutalizing her anyway because she called the cops on the cops. So you can't reach out to the federal government because we see that the federal government is in collusion with these private prisons and they're pretending to be ignorant, like they don't know what's going on while putting out these reports saying you violated all these constitutional rights. And at the same time, instead of enforcing those rights or using the military as they're supposed to when your rights are being violated, you know, you swore that oath to defend the Constitution of the United States of America, instead of using them, calling out the National Guard to rescue Chicago, to rescue St. Louis, to rescue New Orleans, to rescue Mississippi, to rescue Alabama, instead of doing that, they're just pushing their agendas forward. More prisons, more jails, more cops, more judges, more courts, more prosecutors. Well, there you have it. We're coming to our next segment, and every week we do our rider of the 21st Century Underground Railroad. This week I picked out this gentleman because not only is he an exoneree, but he is also a leader among men who is working to exonerate other men like himself, and has recently led the charge to investigate the prosecutors in New Orleans, in Louisiana, prosecutors like those that railroaded him into prison. Scotty Reed, there is a video there where he speaks in his own words. It's on New Abolitionist Radio's Facebook page is about 2.5 minutes long or so.
All right.
So if you want to play that, we'll keep his own story today.
If you'll keep talking while I load it up.
Yes. I'll read the intro. A writer of the 21st Century Underground Railroad is John Thompson, who spent 18 years in prison for a robbery and murder he did not commit, 14 of them on death row in solitary confinement in the infamous Angola prison in Louisiana. He was exonerated after evidence covered up by the New Orleans prosecutors surfaced after his seventh and final execution date was issued for May 20th, 1999.
All right, it's still taking a while to load. All right, here we go. Let me start it over.
My name is John Thompson. I was born and raised in New Orleans, Louisiana, where I was took to trial for first-degree murder and armed robbery and convicted of both crimes, two crimes to which I didn't commit. I stayed on death row for 18 years. I've been exonerated now for several. At my new trial, we discovered the three eyewitnesses who was at the scene of the crime who said it was one man. We discovered the description that they gave was 6 feet tall, medium built, and a bald head. I was 5'8", like 110 or 115 with a big old afro bush like Michael Jackson and them back in the day. So it was clearly that the jury took 5 minutes to find me not guilty of this charge, and I became exonerated in 2003, March of 2003. Right now, as I say, right now I have, I work with guys helping them reentry back into society. Guys was such as myself first. We started off with exonerated guys, and once we when I come home, we didn't have compensation laws or nothing passed in the state of Louisiana, and I took that as my mission to try to seek these right out some of these wrong things that happened to us. And one of the ones was creating an avenue where we can be financially stable, should be at least. It's been a hard battle. We accomplished it. And now we have a transitional house where we have transitional living for exonerees who come home from prison and don't have families to go back to. Because one thing we did realize that most guys stay on death row for an average of 13 or more years. And in that period of time, most of the family members might be moved on or maybe even dismissed from this earth. So we thought we needed to help each other. We needed to do something to help other people that was in our situation. So we raised money to buy a big house. We bought this big old huge house that it was basically a warehouse at one time. And upstairs we converted it into a living quarters. Downstairs we got a training facility. We got a printing company going on right now. We have a computer literacy class going on in there right now. And the biggest thing I love, what I do, is helping guys get their voices back. What we did, we get with a creative writer. We write our stories and we go out and tell our stories. Right now, we done travel just about all over the world. But it's just my meaning in Louisiana. And I think this power that they give them back of their voice, or have an opportunity to tell these stories and tell it in an educational way where it could be understood, it's give them that strength that like nothing I ever seen before. And so I find a lot of reward in what I do.
Indeed. Salute to Brother John Thompson. John Thompson is part of the Witness to Innocence organization, which helps other people like himself, much like the Innocence Project. And I hope more organizations like this start to sprout up that can save young men, old men, women, children from these prison sentences. Imagine all of those years in death row, and then 35 minutes was all it takes to overturn this entire case.
Salute, brother. Salute.
Salute. The other news, Thompson, is he is now trying to achieve another means of justice through his complaint to the federal government. In it, he draws parallels between Williams' conduct in his case and several others. Thompson also references sworn statements made by Williams, the prosecutor, in which he says he handled evidence in the case in the exact manner he was taught, in the way he had done in some 100 additional homicide cases. The New Orleans Parish District Attorney's Office did not immediately respond to calls for comment on Thompson's
I have, I have a comment real quick, mental note. It may not apply to his case since, you know, they got him back when the Jackson 5 was popular. So I don't know if the Geo Group didn't have a contract in Louisiana to keep the prison, what, 100%, yes, 90%, 80%, how much the contract. And he was talking about, you know, the funds and being compensated for, you know, you put me into slavery and I didn't even commit any kind of crime. And so, you know, seemed to me that the GEO Group or the Correction Corporation of America, for any wrongful convictions that's happening now and you have a contract with the state to keep the prisons full, there should be let's say, what do we, these guys and women and children should sue them. Sue these companies, man, and go at them that way. We want to abolish them. We still want to push that bill. You know, what is it, the 2016 Justice Act? What is it, guys? The 2016
Justice
Act? Yeah, we do, because that would abolish the private prisons. But until such a thing could occur, such a win as such as that, as individual victims, what they should do, or either file class action lawsuits, maybe even the families. You owe me because you stole my daddy. You stole my brother. You stole my son. So expand the victims. You see what I'm saying? I'm trying to formulate this through a civil manner without picking up the gun and starting, you know, right, Civil War II and abolishing slavery for real. So, you know, to try to cripple these companies any way I can think of, you know, or to make a suggestion to those who are in place and have the resources to fight those legal battles. All I can do is present, you know, some information and ask for people's feedback on that legal strategy. But, I've never heard of the GEO Group or Correction Corporation or any private prison corporation that has held one of these innocent victims of slavery, paid them. It's always the taxpayer. The taxpayer always, that's us.
Right. Same thing with police violence. It's the taxpayers on the hook. Same thing with all of it. You know what? You know when the state pays is like New York City, for example, when we was finding out about Scott Stringer, the New York City comptroller, basically going against Ken Thompson's conviction integrity unit, saying we can't afford to get all these innocent people out of prison. We can't afford to pay the bill for all. If everybody gets $1 million, you can't go in and win 100 cases even. We can't afford to pay these people. Now, mind you, the city took in $2 billion from low-lying quality of life fines, tickets, traffic tickets, municipal fines, parking tickets, brought in over $500 million alone. But when you're talking about letting out people, even in the one case with Louis Scarcella, 140 cases, I think, is somewhere there about, that are under review out of his murder convictions over the course of his career, and they've already had 10 or 12 people that have been released that never did anything, just from that one cop. So you're talking about all those dozens and dozens of precincts with corrupt cops just as bad as him, and the dozens of other corrupt cops just as bad as him right there in the same precinct where he worked at. You're talking about literally tens of thousands of people, and you can't convince me otherwise. It's tens of thousands of people just in the NYPD roles that they put into the prisons. Now, you add that Baltimore, you go to Philly, you go to Dallas, you go to L.A., you go to Miami, you just keep going around city to city where this is business as usual, and we got 2.5 million in there, and another 9 to 10 million that's under some type of supervision. There's people that's walking around just straight up zombified because life has been literally just stolen from them. This is slavery just like it was from 1550 to right now. It's the same stealing people and stealing their lives and completely warping their minds. They don't even know what just happened. You just took my life. Where do I even start trying to figure out how to be a person again?
Terrible. It is absolutely terrible. Well, we've got about 10 minutes left, and I guess we should move on to our abolitionist in profile. Brother Johanan, will you be reading that today?
Well, I sure can. We
I just posted it on New Abolitionist Radio, so you can have easy access to it.
I got it here.
Let me know when you're ready,
right,
bro.
Here in front of me, Charles B. Ray. I got it here in front of me, Brother Scotty. If you want to go ahead and get right to our abolitionist in profile this week. Charles Bennett Ray, a journalist, clergyman, and abolitionist, was born in Falmouth, Massachusetts on December 25th, 1807. He attended school in his hometown, and then in the 1830s, he was given the opportunity by abolitionists to attend Wesleyan Seminary in Wilbraham, Massachusetts, to study theology. He also studied in Middletown, Connecticut at Wesleyan University, but left because of racial tensions. Ray worked after 5 years on his grandfather's farm, then later went on to learn the boot-making trade. When he moved to New York City in 1832, he opened a boot and shoe store. He also became a Methodist minister. In 1834, Charles Ray married Henrietta Jean Green Regulus on October 27, 1836. She, along with her newborn, died while giving birth. Then in 1840, he married Charlotte Augusta Burroughs. They had 7 children together. 2 daughters, Charlotte T. Ray and Florence Ray, became the first black female attorneys in the nation in the 1870s. In 1833, Charles Ray joined the American Anti-Slavery Society and was a conductor on the Underground Railroad. He dedicated most of his life to the abolitionist movement. In 1837, Ray changed denominations and became a congregational minister. Then in 1843, he joined the New York Vigilance Committee, which involved 13 black and white men who assisted runaway slaves. In 1848, Ray became the corresponding secretary for the committee and remained an active member for 15 years. Ray, in 1837, had been pastor of the predominantly white Crosby Congregational Church in New York City. Beginning in 1845, he served as the pastor of the Bethesda Congregational Church, another mostly white congregation, and continued there for more than 20 years. Ray, a paid staffer with the American Missionary Association, believed strongly in the temperance movement. He was also a member of the New York Society for the Promotion of Education Among Colored Children and the African Society for Mutual Relief. In 1837, he became a general agent of the Colored American, a fourth weekly published by African Americans. 1 year later, he and Philip A. Bell became co-owners. Ray became the sole owner and editor in 1839 when Philip A. Bell resigned. Ray used the Colored American to promote the moral, social, and political elevation of the free colored black of free colored people and the peaceful emancipation of the slaves. Ray traveled across the northern states giving speeches condemning the prejudice that African Americans endured. Ray and his newspaper supported the newly founded Liberty Party in 1840 because it was the only political party at the time to publicly condemn slavery. Charles B. Ray died in New York City on August 15, 1886. He was buried in Cypress Hill Cemetery in Brooklyn, and New Abolitionist Radio salutes you, brother.
Salute. There's one, well, there's two things that I hear to stand out, this story to stand out for me. One is, this is my wife's relatives. She is a direct descendant of Charlotte Augusta Burroughs. So
right on.
One of her relatives. Indeed.
Right on, right on, man. You'd be surprised, man, if you do some digging, look at census records, and, you know, you could just do that without paying for, you know, the, they have what they call it, ancestry type websites and what, but you could do your own, you know your parents' name, what were their parents' name, okay, what were their parents' name, it's in the census records, and, you know, I was able to find out that I'm a descendant of somebody who actually fought in the American Revolution from right here where I am right now.
That's awesome. And you know, the other thing that stood out for me, Scotty and Johannes, is Ray and his newspaper supported the newly founded Libertarian Party in 1840 because it was the only political party at the time to publicly condemn slavery. We find ourselves in that same position. The
right.
only reason we really pushed
right.
with Bernie Sanders because he was the only one
right.
to actually come out and say something about this prison for profit situation. So we lent our support not for him, but against his opponent, so to speak, in
right,
order to give him
right.
more of a push.
Right.
But
it was
we're in
more promoting
position,
the
reaching
policy.
Out now to these third parties trying to get somebody to say something, and nobody will say anything.
But it's somebody in a system, you know, what Bernie Sanders' campaign represented is somebody in the system acknowledging and therefore giving credibility to the abolitionist movement. Because why would you be wanting to abolish private prisons if they, for what? You know what I'm saying? And they are, that's acknowledging the evils of modern day slavery, even though you ain't calling it modern day slavery, but that's a win for us. you know, as abolitionists. Now, that bill still needs to get pushed through, but I doubt if any of the CEOs that get installed in that, they're probably going to stall for 8 to 10 or however long. You know what I'm saying? Donald Trump is pro-private prisons. Hillary Clinton has taken so much money from them, as we talked about earlier in the earlier stories about how they buy politicians and what have you. So, you know, but that right there was just credibility to our movement, acknowledging our movement. And you even confronted Max personally on the ground, members of his campaign team, and presenting the abolitionist argument.
Word. Well, we're at the conclusion of our program. Final statements for the evening. Something to leave in the minds of our listeners until we meet again next Wednesday here on Black Talk Radio Network.com, New Abolitionist Radio. Either one of you brothers want to show us all for tonight?
Man, I can go. I'll make mine brief. We've said quite a bit tonight, so if you're listening to this, you made it through the program. Thank you for that. I mean, honestly, the short attention spans of people and the apathy of people, I salute you for making it this far into it, and especially hearing the things that may shock you and upset you and hurt you to your soul. But we can't give up. You know, you made it through this, so go back, take notes, Google research, start ordering books, start making connections. A lot of the people that we work with and talk to and work through are people that you can find on Facebook and throughout social media, Twitter and what have you. You can befriend a lot of these people. You can find us and join up, man. Get involved. Develop a relationship with us and with people that are trying to do this. And let's put our minds together. Let's put our souls, bound one to another. I mean, this brother that we just talked about is the abolitionist in profile. You could see a combination of him trying to work with other people during his time, but then also a lot of times he had to just do it himself. And what he was facing during that time was the same thing as we're facing right now. He was traveling across the northern states giving speeches condemning prejudice that African Americans endured. He could have a job right now. We need propaganda dissemination just like Scotty Reed does with this network. We need that right now. So, you know, there's more work to be done. We need more hands to the plow. We need more workers in the field. If you hear this, come on out and help us out. Peace to the abolitionists and death to the oppressors.
Yeah, I'll keep mine short and brief. I think that it is, if you just look at the evidence that we present on a weekly basis on this two-hour program, that you can't walk away. You can't listen to 2 hours of any of these programs live or listen to the podcast and walk away and still believe that slavery was abolished after the Civil War, you know, because we lay it out. But, I mean, don't take our word for it. If you are an educated person, I would suspect at least if you got a 12th grade, let's just say you graduated high school. All right, go look up the 13th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Read it for yourself. I'm not going to read it to you. Read it to yourself. I got it memorized, but go read it for yourself. I don't want to influence you with inflections in my voice or, you know, some of the propaganda tools and what have you, but go read it for yourself, and I bet you'll walk away just like I did about 3.5 years ago, maybe 4 years ago, and say, damn, how did they pull off this lie for so long? And so once you come to that realization, to me, if you got any kind of heart, any kind of compassion, any kind of empathy for anyone, regardless of their the melanation levels that they may have in their skin, regardless of any of that, you know, if you don't choose abolitionism, then let me just say you on the other side of the battle lines when Civil War II breaks out in slavery.
Indeed, Scotty. I'm just going to say this real quick, and this is a message to the Black Lives Matter movement, to my people out there personally. First of all, you need to know 3 things. 1, slavery never ended. 2, Black Lives Matter behind bars, too. And 3, abolition is a reason for a revolution so we can finally know peace. Peace.
Rise up, rise up, rise up. Rise up, 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 rise up.
It's showtime, folks.
Just lift your eyes up. Let your wise rise up. See the signs of the times. If it's time, rise up, rise up. When death and hell dwell among all God's people, when those we chose and trusted have become completely corrupted and inherently evil, when the feast that feeds you starves our father's children, when snuff, porn, and pedo forms begin to get top billing, rise up. When famine claims millions, when justice gives blind eyes to billions, when the Lord's anger is no longer feared, if his protection is gone and your enemies are near, if you've seen the seas spill over and the mountains shake, break, and fall, if the moon ever turns blood red and you can't see the sun at all, rise up, no matter if the prize is high in the sky.